listening to Icons and Icons, a Final Fantasy XIV Game Club podcast. This is episode 56, covering the search for Lady Iceheart in an attempt to stop Nidhogg's siege of Ishgard. I'm your host, Chris Taylor. My pronouns are he, him, and with me as always is my esteemed co-host,
Ryan Beatty. My pronouns are they, them.
What happened last time?
Last episode, we won a trial by combat to free Alphanode and Tataru from false accusations of conspiring with heretics. Then immediately, after hearing a rumor that Relban was set to be executed, we launched a rescue mission in Thanalan and confronted Ilbird and the traitorous Crystal Braves in the process. When everyone was safe, we learned more about a plot that the Sultana cooked up with Lolo Rito that suggests she might still be alive somewhere. We begin this episode with a quest called To Siege or Not to Siege.
We're still celebrating Relban's rescue when Tataru calls Alphanode on the Link Shell and informs us that the Jirvanians are preparing to resume their siege of Ishgard. Back at the Fort Thomas Manor, we learned that a band of trappers returning from the west claimed they saw a cloud of dragons big enough to dim the sky. If you ask someone, it's like, I wonder how many that is. Incredible stuff. It's very funny. He's like, is it like 100? Now, Edmott seems prepared to not only not ask for our help, but refuse it if we offer it. He feels like it would go against the offering of protection he's given us while in Ishgard. Still, we now have a choice to make between remaining in a besieged Ishgard and seeking sanctuary elsewhere. The observatorium bells have tolled and all of Ishgard must prepare for war. Alphanode remarks that it seems like we really can't be safe no matter where we run to, and he, for one, is tired of running. It's that frail body. Astidian would agree.
Yeah.
We can't be the light of the realm while hunkered in a hole. He asks us how we feel, and we decide to stay and fight.
So this is one of the spots where there are dialogue options that only really change this one brief scene, and I was curious this time.
They're weird. They're not like the normal dialogue option interface. What is that?
Yeah, no, it's super weird. And also, you know, usually they give us choices that are just different flavors of the same agreement. But in this one, you can also either say we cannot stay here or humph. And if you do that, Alphanode goes, that is your answer? By the 12, how could you? And then thinks for a second and goes, but wait, mayhap remaining in the city would not best serve our friends and allies. Mayhap there is another choice. And so it all goes to the same place immediately. It was just funny for like Alphanode to get kind of mad at you and then be like all Malcolm Gladwell about it and be like, well, maybe if you look at it a little differently, we could make a lot of money from Big Pharma by convincing. No, sorry. That's too much Malcolm Gladwell. So Alphanode thinks that it is only right to ask Tataru what she thinks, because she is the third scion here about to be trapped in Ishgard, and she's also the one who fucking sucks at fighting. So it makes sense to, you know, ask the person who is going to be the worst at it if it's cool to fight. So we take it outside the manor to discuss it as a trio.
If you talk to the people before you leave, Horsherfot is like, wow, we're all gonna fucking die, but we'll die honorably for Ishgard. Just the fucking Seattle ass motherfucker.
On the one hand, Ishgard seems like it can't really survive another hot war with the dragons. But on the other hand, dragons and men are not exactly on speaking terms, except for Lady Iceheart. And so Alphanode has this crazy scheme to use this person who's been, like, you know, doing terror attacks on Ishgard's outposts for a really long time to serve as a liaison between humans and dragons and convince Nidhogg to stop his blood feud. For what it's worth, Tataru thinks that this is a dog shit plan.
I love how we only have to go through all of the effort of linking up with Lady Iceheart because we didn't tell anyone that we're also just hanging out and talking to a dragon all the time.
Yeah. I mean, we can't, right? Like, it's just, or at least Minfilia says that we can't, but we really shouldn't do what she says anyway.
That's right. If her ideas were so good, she would still be alive. Astidian overhears us and makes demands to accompany us. Even with Iceheart as an intermediary, Nidhogg's blood rage might make him impossible to reason with. I don't know why you would think that. It's only called blood rage. Chill out, dude.
Yeah.
However, Astidian believes the meeting could at least delay the assault for long enough for Ishgard to get more prepared for the siege.
I think he looks so goofy when he's walking around town in his full Azure Dragoon armor, because it has the like Griffith helmet. And so he just he looks so extra and goth when he's just like around other people and no one says anything. He looks so corny.
Well, it doesn't have eye holes.
Right. Yeah. How the fuck does he see?
It implies that he has eyes somewhere in or around his mouth. And I'm trying to decide what the most upsetting place for them to be. Is it in the corners of his mouth, like out on the outside, or like Pikachu cheeks, but they're eyeballs? Or is it like inside the back of his throat, which is why he's so talkative?
Oh, my God. It's definitely the throat.
Astinian reveals his true desire. Between the dragon's powers given to him by Nidhogg's missing eye and our prowess as the Warrior of Light, we might be able to kill Nidhogg in a preemptive strike. Joke's on you, not with the people in Party Finder, buddy. Elphinode feels safer with the Azure Dragoon around, but makes Astinian promise not to attack unless the diplomatic talks fail. Astinian agrees to that condition and puts Iceheart under the same protection. Then he advises us to keep this plan quiet around Ser Aemerich in order to protect him from accusations of consorting with heretics.
This version of Astinian kind of clashes with the version of Astinian that we got in the 30 to 50 Dragoon storyline, who was just like so extra and melodramatic and so consumed with rage. And here, all of a sudden, he's very stoic and reserved. And I know that like it's like, you know, he at the end of Dragoon level 50, like disappeared, never to be seen again. And then he shows back up. So, you know, I guess he had a long dark night of the soul in between then and now, but it does feel jarring.
Well, we know why he disappeared, and the way they do it is like a weird retcon of 30 to 50.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Because they're like, oh, I'm just wandering. I didn't steal it. I'm just wandering around with it so that way Nidhogg will follow me.
Right, right, right. When during 30 to 50, he was like, no, I stole it so that I could go seek him out and kill him myself. Yeah, it's a little weird, but whatevs. Alphanode asks Tataru to stay behind and tell House Fortomp that the Scions mean to do all in their power to ensure that Ishgard and her people survive. We speak to Aemerich inside the tribunal and try to reveal as little as possible while also asking that he delay any preemptive strikes and just to trust us. He obviously wants to know more, but the fact that the Warrior of Light and the Azure Dragoon are allied on this alleviates a lot of his misgivings, and he's just kind of like, okay, well, if it helps, I guess I won't ask anything else. Astinian has very dude trust me energy here. We learn that the most zealous Holy See advocates want to attempt a counterattack that seems like nothing more than a suicide mission and a chance for a glorious death. Now that we have Aemerich's support, we have to act quickly before Nidhogg's host is big enough to launch their attack. We have to track down Lady Iceheart, win her over, and then locate and parley with Nidhogg.
Inside the vault, Chris Taylor continues to wonder how he missed the whole Knights of the Round thing, as they're all just hanging around a literal round table. Oh, you know what? I forgot to bring up this other thing. Okay, so when we're on our way to talk to Aemerich, I love that Ishgard has the dumbest place names and that they commit to them extremely hard, because the quest objective here is enter the seat of the Lord Commander within the congregation of our Knights Most Heavenly, and like, it wraps to two different lines, three lines if your text size is set very large. It's incredible.
That's great.
I love that. Now that I'm no longer distracted. Inside the vault, Archbishop Thordrin is there, hanging out by a round table with some knights, entreating Zephyrin, the member of the Heaven's Ward, who was ordered to apologize to us after Tataru and Alphanode's release. Thordrin wants the dragons to come to Ishgard. With the Divine Blade, he believes they can drown the heretics in their master's blood and even defeat Nidhogg. I like that those were, like, separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He just bleeds a lot.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he wants a river of blood, and Nidhogg wants an ocean of blood, and so they're going to have to battle it out to see how big the body of blood's going to be.
Can we settle on, like, a reservoir?
Yeah, come on.
it. Look, that's diplomacy, baby. When Ishgard has rid the world of dragons entirely, he can reward his Asian allies for their assistance. Zephyrin is nervous that the Asians, who he calls the Paragons, might be able to see through their deception with their strange powers. Thordrin chastises him for a lack of zeal. The Asians have given him the power to excise the root of an evil that has blighted Ishgard for 1,000 years, so the risk is worth the reward. Zephyrin wonders what he should do about our plans, and the Archbishop tells him to leave us be and that we all have our role to play, especially him and the Knights of the Heaven's Award. Blue magic streaks the air surrounding Zephyrin, and when he speaks again, his voice has been amplified and pitch shifted in the exact same way that, like, primal voice is.
Yeah.
And he says, "For the glory of King Thordon."
Very telling there. Maybe they're tempered.
If only there was some notable Final Fantasy summon related to knights and round tables.
I want to point out that the song that's playing in this cutscene is, I think, is a good one. It's called The Heaven's Ward, and it is like very like martial. It's got like a lot of war energy and a lot of like scheming villain energy. And it's like kind of related to the Ishgard theme, but just a different arrangement of it. It's sick.
What's funny to me is that they will use the Heaven's Ward cinematic song in a lot of places, but they've clearly remixed it and turned down the really awful vocals so you can't hear the horrible compression they decided to go with.
Yeah.
It's very good. You can still hear that it just goes in the background and you have no idea what's happening. Incredible stuff.
It's like how that one Metallica album, the best and least overcompressed version of it was in Rock Band.
Yeah. Death Magnetic.
Yeah. Before we leave, we go and tell Tataru that we might be gone for a while. Tataru, in turn, has made a new winter outfit for Alphanode, which, thankfully, I don't have to look at his weird, like, side cutouts anymore. Now he's wearing, like, a super long blue coat, a black turtleneck, goofy little white half tie, and, like, white boots. He thinks it looks good. That's all that matters. Clearly, Tataru has also gotten much better, at needlework, because that's what she does with her hands while she's listening out for rumors of the other Scion's locations.
That's right. All women have home skills genetically built into them, and all they need to do is not be distracted by work.
Fuck. Tataru, the home economics Scion.
That's right. the Choad fabric primal.
Michaelsis.
That's right. There you go. You did it.
Yeah. To begin our search for Iceheart, we first return to the Falcon's Nest and ask Redwald if there has been any recent heretic activity. He directs us instead to speak with his men out in the field. We head for the heretic refuge at the old abandoned Gorgon Mill. We travel north once again. Sorry. Yeah.
That's okay. We travel to the north once again. Now that it's not the dead of night and we're not hot on the trail of some heretic footprints, we can better see how the sudden climate change has devastated Gorgon Mills. Fully rolled bales of hay sit abandoned, collecting snow, and huge windmills with sail-like fins stand completely still, frozen solid and covered in imposing icicles. The previous expedition to the mills has uncovered a sheaf of letters that might lead to more clues when they were ambushed from the shadows by huge white beasts that the heretics must have left behind as security. Several soldiers are badly wounded and they cannot complete their work until the monsters are slain. This is extremely fucking funny. Have you never seen a bear before in your life, my guy? This used to be a heavily wooded region. You should know what a bear is.
Although one of the many bears is fucking huge and stands on his hind legs. I would be scared of that one bear, but all the other bears are chump shit.
That bear only has like 20% more health than the other guy. That's weird to me.
Yeah.
We enter the mill after Alphanode and find that he has already killed one of the bears that was in the stables. He was ambushed and reacted, and is now riding such an adrenaline high that he doesn't think he can help us with the rest of them downstairs, because downstairs is too small for there to be multiple people fighting in it. Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There's a tame polar bear and a large war bear in front of the altar where we last met Iceheart. And we kill them and let expedition leader know he can finish his investigation.
We then pick up the heretic letters that got scattered during the attack. And these letters turn out to be logistical correspondence between the heretics stationed in the mills and the like main base of Ak-Afa Amphitheater.
I think the one of the stables was probably lewd. Otherwise, why would you read it in the stables? Why is that one so far away from all the other ones?
That's just some Iceheart fanfic.
That's right. Her frost rimmed dot dot dot.
God. These letters suggest that the caves and ruins that Ishgard thought the heretics abandoned after the failed Shiva summoning might still be where they're hiding. Estinian remarks that Ak-Afa means eternal circle in dragon language, so it makes sense that they would return there. Alphanode is determined to check out Ak-Afa Amphitheater himself and believes the aetherite that Moonbreda wrenched open for us way back in 2.x might still be active if the mill's heretics could still communicate with Iceheart. Ishgard, the soldiers of Ishgard have been busy mapping the tunnel system beneath Snowcloak since the climactic heretic fight during the 2.x patch cycle, so it is now possible to reach the aetherite from this side of the wall. We head to the very bottom of the river valley at the east end of the Western Highlands. Alphanode is having flashbacks to the Snowcloak mission, because it was his only true W as the commander of the Crystal Braves before everything went to shit. And he tells us to prepare for battle since we don't know what exactly will be waiting for us on the other side of the Aetherite. His flashbacks here just made me wonder, okay, Alphanode, what the fuck have you learned then? Because you're still going in and arrogantly thinking that you can use your little Lord Diplomacy powers to fix everything. You just don't have a whole like mercenary army behind you this time, I guess. He's making the same mistakes.
Notable that Alphanode's only W in all of A Realm Reborn was the only time he didn't do anything.
Yeah. He just stayed outside.
That's right. He's just out there like, some weather we're having, huh?
The duty starts and we don't really get a teleport animation. We just show up in the middle of the amphitheater and then find some heretics licking their wounds. They're all extremely pissed that we're back since we banished their saint and everything. Alphanode tries his diplomat routine again and attempts to parlay with these heretics, and they're like, fuck no, the Azure Dragoon's with you. We know what he does, and so you are clearly not here for diplomacy. And Alphanode is just like, fine, I guess we'll fuck you up then, and we start fighting.
I'm very... The amphitheater is very perplexing to me, because it's very clearly outdoor ruins. But if it's outdoor ruins, why don't the knights just land there? We know they all have flying chocobos now. What are we doing?
Yeah. I have no clue what the geography of this place is, that it's inaccessible but still has an open sky.
Yeah, that's weird. When the battle starts, we're fighting two magic users and two swordsmen. More and more heretics will spawn in. And if the swordsmen are left alive too long, they will transform into monstrous dragon-human hybrids. Good news, as a summoner, I can tell you, as a highly bursty class, they do this at a fixed health percentage. Estinian and Alphanode mostly hold their own and don't need to be babysat. At one point, a heretic named Louis Stois of the First Line...
It's so dumb. It's Louis Stois. It's Louis Stois, but with a T, and he's evil.
That rocks.
Now.
That rocks, though. Yeah. So Louis Stois, the First Line, shows up and tells us that we should not have showed up here. He fights Estinian for a bit, and then transforms into an even bigger were-dragon, which you can ignore until last, because Estinian has more hit points than God.
Yeah.
Dragon Louis Stois has a charge attack that may have been dangerous around when this came out, but he's pretty toothless now. We kill him and then clean up the straggling wild-eyed swordsmen and mages. When the battle is over, the heretics are on the ground, gasping and panting that we fight like demons, and then tell each other we should retreat to the cinders in order to avoid death. Alphanode does not give chase, but is sad that there's no sign of Lady Iceheart and no remaining heretics to question. Bro, you're the class that knows sleep.
Yeah, come on, cast that shit. Estidian then points out that actually they told us exactly where they were going. They talked about the cinders. And even if an ambush awaits us there, we will at least be able to find more heretics to question. When Alphanode confesses that he has no idea what the cinders might mean, Estidian explains that he believes it's the heretic's name for an island in the frozen lake of Ashpool that Ishgardians call the Dreaming Dragon.
It's a little distracting to me that Estidian just exists to basically be like Encarta Encyclopedia to you.
Yeah, yeah. He's there to be the Ishgard lore guide.
And otherwise to just sit silently in the background and do nothing. It's weird.
Right, right. He's just seething. But he's not even seething because he's not even like Estidian angry during this entire quest chain. Ishgard has a legend of an Azure Dragoon who fought a titanic dragon on this island 500 years ago. Rather than killing it, though, an entire chapter of the Holy Sea's sorcerers weakened it and forced it into a magical sleep. Ash and cinders began to fall upon the sleeping dragon, covering it in a layer of gray, which was then covered in a thick layer of ice. We decide that this island should be our next location to investigate. Before we go that far west, though, Estidian wants to stop by Twin Pools, where a man named Jantalot, or Jantalo, I'm going to say Jantalot because it's funnier, may have some useful information. He is the leader of a group called the Convictors, a collection of amateur dragon slayers who have made camp there. Estidian is hoping that these Convictors have encountered enough heretics that they might prepare us better for an ambush. We follow the frozen river west, past the heretic meeting place and Riversmeet, and come upon a small camp built against a cliff wall, fortified with giant sharpened spears and patrolled by rough-looking and surly-tempered men.
I love all of these guys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're just, like, fucking lazy assholes. They're great.
The one guy who's like, I haven't seen any heretics. I should take a screenshot because he's just like, I can't be bothered to keep track of every A, B, and C. And they're like very specific names that come through the camp. And I look around the camp and none of those guys are there, but you know where they are. They're the guys who patrol in between the Falcon's Nest and here. So they do actually show up all the time.
And they're all just like, whatever, this is fine.
Also,
I don't give a shit about you.
Shout outs to Boris Banneret, who goes, ah, 'tis colder than Lady Iceheart's frost rimmed soul. Greetings, my lady. Fine day, isn't it? Incredible.
All these pieces of shit.
They rock. The Convictors are a group of petty nobles and lowborn independent soldiers looking to gain power through the only means that is available to them, stabbing the native people. The incredibly stratified Ishgardian society only allows upward mobility to the masses through heroic feats of glory, such as killing a powerful dragon. Which is so funny. That's like the only way I can gain standing in society is going into the nursing home and killing the oldest person there. That's what this is.
Yeah. It's some Logan's Run shit.
That makes it good, though, now. You can't do that.
Okay, no, it's not Logan's Run shit. It's what you said.
However, most of the convictors have become so single-minded about their own personal ambitions that they don't work together, and most of them don't even seem very good at killing dragons. They are attended by a small group of provisioners who are desperately trying to keep them clothed and fed. One of these guys just seems like is perpetually doing the "oh god, I'm freezing to death" loop. Why are you here? Yeah. How did you survive so long?
And he's the mender and, like, equipment merchant. It's like, put on some of your own wares, dude. Yeah,
do better. When we find Jantelot sitting by the fire, he tells Alphanode that he looks too frail to join the convictors and survive more than 3 days. I agree. Astinian vouches for his strength before Alphanode can embarrass himself. And Jantelot's like, who are you to argue with me? Oh, look, it's the Azure Dragoon. Sorry, my guy. Jantelot hasn't seen any signs of Iceheart, but he directs us to question his men ourselves. I feel very bad that we interrupted that guy who was just smoking a pipe.
I know. Let him finish. The convictors are mostly useless. They are so focused on dragon slaying that they do not give a shit about the heretics.
The bow guy has the best excuse. He's like, why would I ever look at the ground? Dragons aren't there.
My whole deal is looking up.
It's like a nega dog.
The convictors are, thankfully there is one soldier on the edge of the camp that can help point us in the right direction at the very least. He's not like the other glory seekers around camp. He was hired by Sir Jantelot's father to keep the petty noble's kids safe. He tells us that a lot of the heretics are lowborn men who were pressed into service against their will by the high houses and then became hyper-focused on how unfair their lot in life is.
Fair.
Yeah, this is entirely like, this is how the alt-right happens. This discontent makes it really easy for the heretics to turn them to their cause, sometimes just the simple promise of freedom. This is how Lady Iceheart's ranks grew so quickly. The soldier laments that he even lost some friends to the heretics, but it was because of these friends that he knows the turncoat's secret signal to the heretics that they are ready to join. Light a fire and send up purple smoke in the Western Highlands.
Man, Lady Iceheart is just doing some Drown Brown shit, huh?
Yeah. And she's more right. Like, the heretics doing a lot of terrorism don't love that, because a lot of the people in Camp Dragonhead are mostly chill, unlike true-ish guardians. But, like, yeah, she's right.
Astinian wants to use a fake purple signal flare to lure the heretics to us. He commands us to go find a woolly yak whose hide is rumored to emit a disgusting smell, but also a bunch of purple smoke when it burns. We kill two of them just in case we need extra, because the Astinian says, oh no, please, you might need to burn more than one, and this is an MMO quest. You gotta kill at least two. We meet the item description for the woolly yak hide is fucking so good, by the way. It's the bristly hide of a parentheses, now hideless, yak. We meet Alphanode and Astinian on top of a bluff, looking out at an enormous gnarled spire of stone and glowing ice aether spikes. Alphanode wonders how he ended up in such a cold and miserable place collecting firewood instead of negotiating. And Astinian goes, oh, must have had such a privileged upbringing. He's never collected sticks before asking for the yak hides. And he's right. Alphanode is like, wow, who knew? Your hands could be so numb yet so sore at the same time. Idiot. You have gloves, baby.
This is such a character building journey for our guy.
Talking to Alphanode at every point through here is so rewarding. It's so good.
He's miserable.
Yeah, it's great. I love this. A thin ribbon of purple smoke wafts upward from our little fire, and Iceheart shows up almost immediately. She says she should have known it was us. She asks us to forgive her comrades for their hostility back at the amphitheater because they were just on edge. She demands to know why we're here. Okay, and this is the cutscene where they say Coerthus in a different way that I hate.
Yeah.
They call it like Curtis. So... No.
Yeah, yeah.
Not doing that.
It was strange to hear that out loud. So Alphanode starts explaining and we start silently explaining And Isart thinks that this plan to stop Nidhogg's assault with words is cute and romantic, but completely futile. If we knew that the spark which lit the flames of Dervahnian animosity towards Ishgard, we would understand how impossible diplomacy would be here. She reveals to us the dragon side of the origins of the conflict. More than 1,000 years ago, an Elizan tribe first sought to claim the lands of Coerthas as its home. However, Coerthas was already home to the dragons, who was like, you can't just take this. This is, we're here. A war broke out that would have led to total extermination of either Elizan or dragons, but one woman named Shiva attempted to parley with the dragons, and in doing so, discovered that they were quite intelligent creatures capable of reason. Oh, they're actually smart. These people, who are clearly people, are actually people. Cool, thanks, Shiva. As everyone was fighting around her, Shiva began to fall in love with the dragon Hraesvelgr, who her own people considered a monster. He also began to fall in love with her in return, but despaired at the comparatively fleeting lifespan of his Elizan lover. Which, you know, just calling into focus the incredibly hashtag problematic age gap. You know, I'm surprised we don't have more Hraesvelgr and Shiva age gap discourse.
Look, they're just destroying Japan's culture, okay?
Fuck Christ.
Becoming too westernized.
At least the 1,000-year-old in this example actually looks 1,000. That's one tiny consolation. Shiva asked Hraesvelgr to consume her body so that their spirits could be intertwined for eternity. After Hraesvelgr ate his lover, the story of their tragic love spread through both warring factions, and everyone stopped fighting now that the souls of their kin were bound together.
Man and dragon learned to live in harmony and collaborated to create a grand nation. The peace lasted for 200 years until Elizan jealousy undid it. The source of the dragon's long lies was rumored to be within their eyeballs. Operating on this belief, a band of knights deceived their Dervahnian allies and ripped one of Nidhogg's eyes out. Until he gets his eye back, no amount of talking will stop him from being mad. Okay, did you see the eye in 30 to 50?
Yes, he does. Okay. He does whip it out at one point. Yeah.
Because if you didn't do Dragoon, this is fucking wild, because this is where you find out it's not figurative. Astinian tries to correct her. He even does like the fucking finger wag at her.
Yeah, fuck off, dude. He raises incredible. His finger.
He knew that Nidhogg coveted his eye and wanted it back. So the Azure Dragoon kept it with him to draw out the Dreadworm away from the city. And then he pulls out a literal eye bigger than Alphanote's head and hair.
Yeah.
And it's just there, still open, glowing with an angry purple energy. It's like if you had the eye of Sauron in your pocket.
Yeah. Yeah. Just this fucking angry, glowing, gigantic orb. It's so funny.
And it's so good, because if you've never done the Dragoon stuff, this is where you find out it's an actual eye. Love it. You should get a bonus in the raid for standing on a certain side of Nidhogg.
You should. That would have been sick.
Astinian, through the eye, can feel that Nidhogg knows the eye is no longer in Ishgard, but he's still fixated on the city itself instead. He can experience Nidhogg's emotions through the eye, and now believes that the dragon has lost all sense and now only desires a sea of blood. The eye glows brighter in response. Alphanode wonders if he could try speaking to Hraesvelgr instead. So far, he hasn't aided in his brother's quest for vengeance and may welcome peace talks. Isart scoffs at Alphanode's naivete, but he agrees to take us to Hraesvelgr nonetheless. It's time to go to Dravania.
Our heart pounds in our ears, and we get an echo flash, which is unusual since Midgard's Hormr stole the echo from us. On the astral plane, the ice crystal reappears and sends a bolt of blue energy into our chests. When we come back, Alphanode notices something off and wonders if all of our battles are finally taking their toll. Mini Midgard's Hormr appears high above us and muses that our connection to Hydaelyn might be stronger than he anticipated. He wonders if it will be enough.
This is stupid.
Yeah.
Like, bro, you did it. Why can't it just be him giving it back because he wants us to learn the truth about this?
Right.
Why is it just, I don't know, it's magic.
Right. Instead, it's like, oh, shit, the Warrior of Light really is powerful, and this isn't some faker. And it's like, my guy, we killed so many primals. We are it.
You were there. I hit you in the neck so many times. You know what's up.
That's it for the main story quest of this episode. But once again, through Heaven's Word, we're going to do a little bit of side quest roundup. There are a ton of fucking dumb fetch quests that we are not going to talk about. But there are a couple that are interesting. Weirdly, most of the blue side quests that give out aether currents, which we are now picking up in order to be able to fly, are the really boring fetch and slay ones. And it's a couple of the yellow side quests that you can tell have cutscenes because they actually have a portrait in the quest window.
Oh, interesting.
Are where there are actual good morsels of story and world building. You would think that they would put their more interesting stories on the more required path, but I guess not. There's also a funny but kind of messed up callback to some NPCs that we met back in the 2.x patch cycle. So one of the people back in the day that we tried to recruit to the Crystal Braves was Carvalane, who is the prodigal son of a prominent Durrandir noble. He had taken on, when we met him, he had taken on a totally new identity in Limsa Lominsa and declined our offer to join the Crystal Braves, and also declined his dad's offer to come back into the House Durrandir because he was extremely happy being a pirate with his new life. Well, it turns out that his personal fighting tutor was so despondent when Carvalane disappeared that he retired entirely from being a knight, became a farmer, and started Gorgon Mills in the Highlands to avoid being reminded of the boy that he thought he lost in Ishgard. We learn this because this knight's widow asks us to place flowers on his grave. So the dude's adventurous spirit and disdain for the life of a noble may have ended up killing his teacher inadvertently because he was, I guess so. We'll cover some of the stuff that you can open up in the Convictory next episode. There is an optional dungeon that we might cover if there's good plot relevance, but there's also a quest chain that has some pretty good character work, but they are both just too long to cover in this episode.
Okay, before we talk about the question we are going to talk about, I want to talk about how right outside the Convictory is the hardest fate of all time. Do you know that? Did you do that one?
No, I haven't done that one.
It's one guy. So you talk, there's a guy standing there, which normally you're like, oh, this is like an escort fate. This is going to really suck real bad. And it's not an escort fate. Some guy wants to fight another guy because he's a coward and is telling everyone that he's great. So you're going to kill a guy because he's a liar, according to this guy. And you do this fight, and this other guy shows up, and A, he has a bow, so you can't just not get hit by this guy. He does a billion damage, has 50 billion health, and it turns out you're out to just kill this guy because when he claimed to slay a dragon, it was like a sick dragon baby.
Oh my god.
That's weird.
The Convictors are like, hey, even we have standards. We don't kill sick babies. Yeah. Except for one. Yeah, that's so goofy. They're your sworn enemies.
It's one of the NPCs in the Convictors camp that you can't talk to, disappears, and moves outside to become the fate-like point for this.
Wow. That's ridiculous.
There's also some other cool unrelated stuff. It's not like really plot related, but there's like a bunch of interesting stuff about the game that they start doing here. If you hang out outside by the entrance to Falcon's Nest, you know that like merchant who like walks out and says, oh, I can't lose another chocobo to Yetis or I'm done for, right? Also, he refers to them as apostrophe bow, which I really hate.
That I don't like that at all.
He like fades off and disappears. But because I'm trying to level up to do the quest as summoner, I'm like doing some baits in the area and he'll randomly appear in and comment to himself about how he's journeying at different points all the way along the way to the Dravanian Highlands where he crosses the border saying, I only have a few more miles to go. So now they have this thing that they do where there are NPCs like moving through the entire environment that you could just kind of follow along, but they don't walk the whole way right yet. It's weird.
That's neat. That's neat and weird. I did not notice those people.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time here. Also, I have died to so many fates. Really, much harder to solo when you're not a tank.
Yeah, for real.
Turned out a lot of times to some wolves. Also, it turned out that I'd forgotten to teach my chocobo choco cure, so that was a big problem.
Yeah, it's, I always forget to go into the chocobo advancement menu and actually like pick skills to learn, and then it's like, why do I keep dying? I thought, oh, right, yes, choco cure.
There's only one correct thing, which is to learn choco cure and then just dump everything into attack forever.
Yep. So yeah, the side quest chain that we are going to cover is a chain of three yellow quests that are kind of a follow up to a lot of the stuff that we did the first time we were at the Falcon's Nest. So after several members of the garrison at Falcon's Nest come down with a sudden illness, Redwald asks us to investigate because he thinks something more sinister might be going on. After making some inquiries, we discover that the culprit was a box of poisoned wine that the heretics planted after their raid on Falcon's Nest, hoping it would be recovered and consumed by the knights. We head to Camp Rivermeet to root out any remaining heretic collaborators. Sure enough, there are a group of malnourished thugs skulking around. They taunt us with the knowledge that the poison was made from the dragon's venom and that there is no known cure, and then they attack us. But they're underfed heretics, so we just, like, wreck their shit very easily. Redwald's reaction to the news that the poison is dragon poison that does not have a known cure is very grim, and he asks us to keep investigating a possible cure so that his six soldiers don't die. So, of course, the one guy that we turn to is Old Man Segan, the guy who wanted to excavate the memories of the snow-covered and abandoned village that used to be at the Falcon's Nest, but, like, was extremely grumpy because the soldiers only cared about fortifying it. And we turn to him because we think he might have ancient knowledge that the current members of the Falcon's Nest don't know about. And he does.
Classic old guy stuff.
Classic old guy stuff. Segan recites an ancient poem that suggests that if we find an animal who is immune to the poisonous brambleweed that the dragons eat to create their poison breath, we might be able to study their immune system and develop an antidote. Segan happens to know that the Black Blood Zoo that roam around Gorgon Mills are likely immune since they eat a lot of the weed themselves.
Fucking relatable. We burned some herbs that Segan gave us to attract the zoo, then kill one and collect its blood. When we give the blood to Segan, Redwald shows up, and Segan just verbally slaps him around a bit for only caring about military defenses and not the folklore and culture of the Highlands. He then implores Redwald to give the zoo blood to his brightest alchemist before it's too late to save the poisoned soldiers. Redwald is kind of shocked that old legends could bear a solution to a problem like this, and then apologizes for previously regarding Segan as an old fool who can't let go of the past. Two things can be true. It's fine. In light of these events, he now realizes that the culture and traditions of the Falcon's Nest hold untold value. This fucking guy. You can't just say that out loud. He offers a sincere apology and asks Segan to lend assistance in a new effort to excavate the old frozen village. That's not anything. Hey, now that I said this thing, will you be happy to help me do the thing I was gonna do anyway?
Yeah. Well, it gets even worse because Segan then demurs and is like, actually, listen, I know that everything that you've done, even though I'm grumpy about it, was done to protect Ishgard. And so honestly, like, a full excavation would be a waste of resources. And so it's like, don't back down on this shit, my guy. So Redwald is like, fine. How about instead you get free hot soup for life? And in exchange, you can be the Falcon's Nest's resident lore master. Segan is like, I don't know about that. Ishgardian cooking is too spicy and salty. And Redwald is like, don't worry about it. Our head cook is Coerthin, not Ishgardian, so the soup will be plenty thin and bland just for you. After all, Redwald now believes that he still has a responsibility to carry the culture and history on into the future. And this made me so mad. Because now, not only do we have, you know,
now we have dragon, a dying tradition instead of an alive tradition, because Segan's like, it would be really hard to lift a shovel.
Right. After he like, basically, like, negs us into collecting all of this old excavated knowledge for him the first time we're in Falcon's Nest, then he's like, it's too hard, actually.
Well, the DA got the goods, and then you were like, nah, I don't want those, actually.
Yeah. And then also, it's just another example of, like, liberal colonialism doing bullshit to, like, small towns. So not only do we have dragon colonialism, where they're trying to genocidally eradicate the people who were here first, but now also, like, the only reason Redwald cares about these old legends is because they provided value for him to extract. Like, it was only because the legends and culture of Falcon's Nest had a material benefit to Redwald that he changed his mind and was like, actually, Seagon, you're okay.
It
has nothing to do with his humanity or anything of that sort. I was just like, Jesus fucking Christ, Ishgard.
I live in a naval-based town and probably can't refer to poisoning the military as direct action.
Fuck.
That's it for the concepts of the episode. What do you think about this section of the game?
It was fun for being like just a single player only series of journey quests, and you know, nothing of crazy import happened, but like it's really fun to clown on Alphanode, and it's really fun to be extremely mad at how shitty Ishgardian society is. And this episode did both.
Yeah, it's great. It is weird to be it's weird to be hanging out with Astinian. Astinian is so far the guy who is still the least like Astinian, because Astinian doesn't even become Astinian until like right before Endwalker.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it's he's just weird. This very like stoic non-character right now who occasionally goes beast mode.
Yeah. Well, that's all until next time. We'll be talking about whatever it is in 2 weeks. The intro's not here, so I'm making it up. So, peace be with you.
And also, you should have some.
Thanks for being a patron. Your continued patronage helps us to make the shows that we all love without it becoming a financial burden or having to put ads in them. In case you didn't know, we have other shows that you might enjoy, such as Being Mr. Boot, Lightning Strikes Thrice, Being Jim Davis, and last but not least, Boku No Stop. You can help us out further by rating and reviewing your favorite show on iTunes and telling a friend about our podcast. Thanks for being a loyal patron. We'll see you next time.